Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create. Hello, and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast for Remainers and Brexiteers alike. Join me, Jonathan Beardmore, every week alongside Alex Davis and Christian Spence as we try and guide you through the choppy waters of Brexit. Hello and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, a podcast all about leaving the EU. We are back with a Monday edition, which is a little bit unusual for us. And as usual, I'm joined by Christian Spence. Hello, Christian.
Hello.
And Alex Davis.
Hiya.
Now, let's go straight into the news. I'm going to say the news, the Barnier news briefing, which he gave, was it on Friday?
Yes, Friday, yeah.
All right, well, before you tell me what you said, why did they do this? What was it for?
I think it was just an update from the EU side. It wasn't anything scheduled as part of the negotiations. It wasn't one of the ones where Davis appears alongside Barnier. It was really just for the Commission to give an update on how they see progress. Because they've started to set out some of their guidelines, essentially, for the next round of negotiations. And so, it was really just a progress update, whilst progress is really, really slow over here.
Now, I'm fairly familiar with the Brexit process now, so I assume you stood up and said everything is going fine and we completely reconciled the British position with what we want.
He said substantial disagreements remain, he has some problems understanding the UK's position.
Right.
He went much further than that. David Davis then obviously came out and was quite mean about what Barnier had said there was some fundamental contradictions with what Barnier was suggesting. This was really Barnier coming out and saying you need to start making some decisions. I think he literally said that. I think it's the time has come to make decisions.
So what are Barnier's fundamental contradictions?
There's three, and I think they're the same three we've been talking about for ages. I mean, one first of all is that we still haven't got agreement on citizens' rights for the transition period.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and in fact, if anything, that's gone backwards.
Yes,
it's gone backwards.
Yeah.
I mean, I mentioned last week that there was a letter sent out to businesses from DexU trying to alleviate some of the fears amongst the business community about what's going to happen during the transition period. And that letter spelled out exactly that there would be no changes to the status of EU workers here. The EU workers who come over during the transition period would, you know, face the same immigration rules that people do who come over today. And it turns out that the government isn't promising any of that, and he's actually asking for something which is the complete opposite, because Theresa May now has come out and said openly that she no longer wants people who come over during the transition period to have automatic right of residency after the transition period.
That's
essentially
it.
So there is an increased burden on business. It is going to be much more difficult for them to hire people. Whereas the EU Commission is still maintaining its position that immigration rules need to be maintained exactly as they are as a full EU member for the duration of the transition period. So that's one area where we're no closer together.
Sorry, so what were the contradictions that David Davis was referring to? Do you know?
The contradictions about he was mentioning, I think that was going back to the whole sanctions issue. So it was in the news last week that the EU were supposedly threatening us with sanctions if we go against whatever we end up agreeing on.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous, because all international agreements include things like that to make sure that each side you know, does what it says it was going to do. Mm-hmm. And he was suggesting that there's a contradiction in the fact that they're threatening us with stuff if we do what they say, if we don't do what they say. Whereas there was kind of nothing doing that the other way. We weren't suggesting anything the other way. So it was really a totally meaningless comment from Davis. It was just him firing back at Barnier.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, just on these sanctions, I do understand what you're saying about you need provisions in any trade agreement in order to make sure both parties hold up their side of the deal.
Exactly.
But there are these sanctions, are they two-way? Would the UK be able to levy these on the EU, for instance, or is it one way?
It's a very good question, which I don't know the answer. Now, the reason the EU has sort of stipulated that, because people have said, well, look, the transition period is aiming to be standstill in every single regard. So the UK will still be under the jurisdiction of the ECJ, which is the body which monitors all of this stuff anyway. Mm-hmm. The reason the EU wants additional sanctioning procedures is essentially, because we're only going to be in this transitionary, in this period of hopefully, slightly less than 2 years, that there wouldn't be time to bring things through the court in a normal way. That's the issue. So essentially, if there is a form of breach, normally that would then go through the ECJ, it would go through the normal legal document. The question is, there may not be time to do any of that, that the UK may have left and ended by the time it's done. So actually, the EU has said, we need a quicker way of remedying any issues. Because ordinarily, if we decided that we were putting an embargo on, you know, Belgian chocolate, that would then just go through the ECJ process in the normal way. The challenge is that will probably take longer than the 20 months we'd have got in a transition period. So there's no, the EU doesn't actually have any recourse.
Which actually is a wonderful example of why the current trade dispute body might not be the best way to do it.
Yeah, exactly. But I think in answer to your previous question, does this work two ways? I mean, theoretically, yes. If we are still a full member, then we have recourse to the ECJ in the same way that
I think theoretically, yes. I think the issue is potentially that we don't have the leverage that they do in this.
Exactly. Yeah. As a departing member.
But I'm pretty sure that whatever agreement we've got with the United States at the moment, it's pretty one-sided. The United States gets a better deal out of it than
There are certain aspects of a number of agreements like that. Open skies is the big one, where, you know, even negotiating, you know, even the heft of the EU couldn't get a balanced deal between the EU and the US and all that. The US got a much better deal out of open skies than the EU did. So,
I've got actually what Barnier said exactly. So he said, they acknowledge today that a way to resolve disputes and infringements is needed, yet at the same time they dismiss the UK's push for reasonable safeguards to ensure our interests are protected. It's not possible to have it both ways. So it's a fair point, but
It is. I mean, we're chatting sort of before the recording. I said increasingly it's very, very hard to see the EU as being unreasonable. I mean, of course it's pushing its luck in some areas, and you'd expect that in negotiations, and that's okay, but it's hard to see it as being fundamentally unreasonable.
I've seen even from the EU side, apparently there's been some people expressing concern at Barnier's language at this news briefing. I think the fundamental negotiating points underlying what he's saying are, you know, I don't have a problem with that at all. But this back and forth between him and David Davis is a bit...
The problem is, I think the tension in the UK government is so enormous. You know, we've talked before, but fundamentally the UK government does not have a position on this. This is why we are still stuck in negotiations where we are now. Means it's highly politically sensitive. And so, I agree with the, as you said, you know, Barnier's substantive points. Becoming inflammatory doesn't really help the situation along any.
Yeah.
Other than that, I think they're just really trying to focus minds, saying, look, you know, we've got the European Council meeting on the 22nd, I think, of March. The idea is hopefully we ratify the concept of a transition agreement and put to bed phase one. Because don't forget, phase one is not complete yet. We reach sufficient progress, not completion. As Alex said, you know, we've got a bit of a rowback from Theresa May on the citizens' rights issues. That's causing Brussels some worry.
Yeah. I think the majorly worrying things that Barnier said in the briefing were, first of all, that, you know, obviously we know this, we've discussed it many times, but outside the single market and the customs union, a hard border is unavoidable.
Yes.
And he also said that the transition period is not a given. I mean, and again, we know that it's not legally binding at this point.
Nope.
It's just based upon the first phase withdrawal agreement that we've made. But At this point, it goes back to the red lines that the government set. We agreed in the phase one withdrawal agreement that there would be no hard border, that we would basically do everything that we can to avoid a hard border. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we want to leave both the single market and the customs union. And as of yet, no one knows how that could work. We haven't yet put forward a solution.
And of course, the danger here is, as we see, you know, one of the things we have talked about historically is how well prepared the EU has been. Kind of since referendum day, really, they've stuck together very well and been very well prepared, which is, you know, not a surprise for anyone who's ever worked with the European Commission. They're an administrative and bureaucratic force in this regard. Now, the challenge is they're ready for all of this. They've been prepared. They've had all the things worked out. And in many ways, the phase one negotiations, the sufficient progress, was determined far more by the EU laying down, frankly, what mm-hmm. how this is going to be, and us having to go to it, just because we haven't set out a strong case for anything else. This is now what's going to happen, I think, with the Northern Ireland border. There's a couple of things that came out, of course, the end of the phase one. We agree that essentially no border between Ireland and Northern Ireland is the default option, mm-hmm. Unless we can come up with anything else, and frankly there isn't anything else if we're going to leave single market and customs union. And the other thing that came out was the citizens' rights issues, and then the agreement was both sides will go away and start drafting the legal texts to make phase one enforceable under international law. We haven't done anything yet, and the EU is about to bring forward its text. And of course, again, because we haven't done anything, we will just be presented with a legal text, and we have no kind of reasonable pushback saying, well, actually, we don't like yours. What we think it should look like is this. What we'll have is just David Davies saying, we don't like yours.
Well, there's another thing which I've seen this week, which is that the government is now saying that it wants immigration arrangements to be slightly different during the transition period. Mm-hmm. And that there will be new systems in place for people to apply for, residency, things like that during the transition period. But none of that work has even been started.
No.
So it's very hard to understand at this point how the EU can take our position on that seriously.
And I think this has been one of the challenges all the way through from the EU, is it's sort of like, well, you're saying things, this idea that we, as Alex said, the idea that we will be in a position to register EU nationals and keep track of them from the 30th of March next year, even if Parliament commits the funding this evening, mm-hmm. is not possible. We will just not be ready. We will not have the systems in place. So at the same time as Theresa May mm-hmm. saying, actually, I want a different system, it's very reasonable for both EU and actually the rest of us here in the UK to say, but you can't. You just won't have any of the IT systems in place.
Yeah.
So how can you even be asking for this? A, the thing you're asking for directly contradicts what us and the EU agreed only about 6 weeks ago. And secondly, the revisions you're now suggesting aren't practically deliverable. So how are we supposed to take you seriously? It's all a bit...
As a nation, have we just forgotten how to do these things? Or the details which are required to run a nation state?
It does sort of feel... I mean, I think we talked about this before, Alex, that the way sort of the Brexit decision and its outcome and everything that's flowed from it has turned a lot of very sensible people into a lot of very bonkers people. We said before, there's lots of people we followed, you know, as either Twitter or as commentators or economists or political analysts who've had huge respect for decades, who have, since the 23rd of June 2016, gone slightly bonkers. There's a lack of... You know, some of the things that I really admired in these people, often, you know, not coming from the same political spectrum or same economic position, but there was rigorous thought, there was intensive analysis, there was clever thinking. It's just kind of becoming parroting lines. So it's like, well, you know, so it's a bit like we've decided we're going to change our immigration arrangements, there you are. It's like, but you can't just...
Change.
You can't just do that. It's the world doesn't work like this anymore.
And we should point out some of the problems that this is causing for businesses. So there was a thread on Twitter from someone and explaining that if you're an EU worker who's over here, but you don't currently have residency secured at this point, and let's say you're made unemployed unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. At the minute, apparently, the waiting list to get that residency right secured is something like 4 months.
Okay.
And so... You know, you wouldn't have thought that you would have to apply for that before you lost your job if that was an unexpected thing. And then from the employer's point of view, you don't know what the immigration policy is going to be when that person's residency is being decided upon. So how can you you know, how can you have confidence in employing that person at this point? It's just...
Yeah, you've got a chance that someone might apply for a job and you want to appoint them, and they have the legal right to work in the UK today, but you don't know whether in 14 months they'll have the legal right, they'll still have the legal right to work in the UK.
And you can't know that, and you'll face a fine if you do employ someone who then ends up not having the correct rights. It creates a situation where...
Yeah, that's staggering. Actually, how would you actually deal with that as a business? It isn't entirely clear.
No, it's not. And frankly, I mean, the only kind of recommendation you've got, apart from A, obviously, if you're listening and this is for you, go and speak to an immigration lawyer, an employment lawyer. But basically, I suspect the default reaction will be don't employ EU nationals.
It becomes risky
because
to
it's just very, very
employ them. Yeah,
you know, this is not a good position for us to be in at a time when the UK government apparently wants to say we are, you know, a global open nation to the world. There are these kind of fundamental difficulties that they're all just wishing away.
All right. Well, let's revisit our fundamental difficulties, because one of the things that we were speaking about prior to the podcast was how Theresa May and the government in general have set out some preconditions for negotiation which simply can't be done because of red lines set up previously. I thought that would be quite a good idea, because these have been, I wouldn't say forgotten about, but we've not spoken about them for a little while. So what are these red lines? Why are they going to cause an issue?
Probably four, something like that. We'll work out as we go through them.
So the first one is no hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland.
Now that's the problem, because as we spoke about length, the customs union, and
the single market. We want to be outside both of those.
That's it. And kind of it's the common. And this is the thing, actually. We still see. I saw you retweet one of Oliver Norgrave's blogs earlier today. Actually, it was a very good one over the weekend. If you've not seen it, on the nature of a customs union. But lots of people are saying, you know, Labour's position increasingly over the last week or two has been, we've got to stay in the customs union to solve the hard border issue. Mm-hmm. Like, the customs union is necessary but not sufficient to remove a hard border. It's the combination of full regulatory alignment and acceptance and a customs union which allows a border to vanish.
So we've got the Northern Irish border,
which has to stay open.
Right. Next one.
We
have to leave the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice.
Now, why might this be a problem?
That's just the sovereignty thing, right?
Exactly. We have to take back control of our laws. This was one of the lines that came back in Theresa May's Conservative Party conference speech back in October in 2016, reinforced at Lancaster House in January last year, 12 months ago now. And that'll rub up against a couple of things we'll come on to next, which is we must take control of our own trade policy, which means exiting the European Union's common commercial policy, which essentially means, not wholly, but kind of practically means leaving the customs union. And we have to take back control of our borders from an immigration point of view, which means leaving the single market. Which is all great, but you can't leave the customs union and the single market and common commercial policy and keep an open border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And nor can you have frictionless trade between the EU 27 and the UK.
Yeah.
So there's always been, and we talked about this, I think, probably since podcast number one, this is an irreconcilable tension that the UK government and, you know, David Davis, particularly Liam Fox, have just sort of tried to wish away. They've said, you know, the Northern Ireland border, we can't talk. They said they couldn't talk about Northern Ireland border in phase one because, frankly, it would only be resolved by the nature of the trade agreement that the two sides sign later. Except there is no precedent for any trade agreement which removes the border. Absolutely no precedent. A free trade agreement on its own cannot do that. These have always been known knowns, if we go back to Donald Rumsfeld and the Iraq War.
So, despite these red lines, that is what you would assume the UK position is. However, we are expecting the UK position to shift over the next 3 weeks.
Well, apparently we're going to have a position at the end of the next week, which will be a starting point.
So the red lines, if you like, are the foundations for a position which we've not yet quite established.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
So give me an example then of, and I think this is quite a good one, one of these, what one of these speeches will be entailing, and why don't you link it to one of the red lines, in particular the ECJ one?
So this is something I've been reading today, that apparently over the next 3 weeks, Theresa May has said that the Cabinet will figure out and set out, I think it's being termed the road to Brexit, is the snap line that the government's come up with. So this is happening over the next 3 weeks. There's going to be 5 speeches over the next 3 weeks, starting with Theresa May this Saturday in Munich, I believe.
Oh, is she going to go to various foreign places too?
Well, they're not all May. May's only doing one of them.
Oh, so, May's doing two.
Oh, May's doing two.
So okay, six so speeches. Yes. May's doing two of them.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Do we know the locations?
No, I think only the first one is solved in terms of date and location at this point. So May's doing two. David Davis is doing one. David Lidington, I believe, is meant to be doing one on security.
Ex-Europe minister, actually very well regarded in his time as a Europe minister. He's the odd one out, of course. The other one is Liam Fox.
Liam Fox is doing one on international trade.
David Linton's kind of the odd one out because he's the pro-EU one of them all. You'll notice, of course, the Chancellor of the Exchequer is missing from that list.
Is Boris Johnson?
The Boris Johnson is also.
Oh, yes, and Boris Johnson. Yes.
So is there a chance that the Cabinet have actually come to a joint position?
It feels unlikely.
Yeah, it goes against everything I've heard so far.
No, I think that's basically impossible, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and whether these six speeches the next 3 weeks actually set out a concrete position. And the other thing is whether they set out the concretes in terms of what's achievable, because my fear, and I suspect most of many businesses' fears, is actually, instead of just, you know, if Cabinet has decided what it wants, then Theresa May get on the 6 o'clock news tonight and just say so. Mm. Don't drag it out over six speeches over the next 3 weeks. If you've got a decision, crack on with it.
Yeah.
Because, frankly, we've been kicking our heels for nearly 2 years now.
I think Boris Johnson is due to do a speech, I think, on Wednesday.
Okay.
But that's about... It's going to be something about... You know the speech that him and Gove did after the referendum result, where it was essentially, for all you people who voted Remain, this isn't the end of, you know, we're not leaving Europe, we're leaving the EU, we'll still be close friends. It seems like it's going to be another one of those, so don't worry about everything.
Yeah.
So Boris is doing one. But the point which you... you know, asked about was apparently May is going to say that we are going to remain part of Europol and we're going to take part in the European arrest warrant, which rubs up against the ECJ red line.
It does, yeah, because it's the European Court of Justice that oversees the arrest warrant scheme. So whether that's one of the lines starting to, the red line's becoming pink or being rubbed out, who knows?
But yeah.
I think the other thing on the speeches, what I say really is, you know, my fear, as I think business fear, is that it just reiterates some of the problems we've had. So that they will go at great lengths to say, we're leaving the EU, we're not leaving Europe, we want to be great friends, we want to strike a deep and special relationship with an important free trade agreement, and we will take back control of our money, borders and laws, and everything will be great.
Yeah.
Because actually, if that's all they say, we have progressed absolutely nowhere. It is, you know, it has got to be, what is the legal text by which you now want to take to the EU in advance of their meeting in 5 weeks and say, this is what we're going to work towards. And deep and special does not cut it.
Well, deep and special also sounds like the exact opposite to the way that they are formulating these policies. I mean, you know, just let's say that this is what they are going to say. They want to stay part of Europol and the European arrest warrant. It's almost beyond belief that they would not have checked that through with an advisor or a researcher or something and come to the conclusion that this goes against the so-called red line.
I mean, I agree.
They just scrap the red line and say, look, we've got it wrong.
They're going to have to scrap the red lines, basically, is my opinion. There's no other way of doing it.
No, at least one of them has to fall.
And which one would you like to fall, if you had your choice? Which one of them is the least appealing?
I don't mind at all if there's ECJ oversight.
No, it seems the easiest one to not worry about, to be honest.
See, how do you think, politically, that is the one that people are going to get most annoyed about?
You might well be right, but it's more about thinking really in terms of practical outcomes. You know, we've been trying to, you know, we've been driven all the way through this last 2-3 year process, it feels like a decade now, about what is it business looking for, and they just want outcomes. I think there's an article in the FT, I think, today, which talks about ministers becoming, you know, these speeches coming through, and one senior Conservative minister being quoted as saying, just make an effing decision, we barely at this stage even care what it is.
Yeah.
And I suspect a huge share of the business community would agree exactly with that. Just we are staring into an abyss, and just any form of what that abyss looks like will be helpful.
I think the problem being is, I mean, the more you kind of look back at the whole Brexit process and the vote, it wasn't necessarily a rational decision. It was very much an emotional decision. And I think what resonates most with voters, which is ultimately what this is going to come down to, what do the voters think, would be the ECJ. I think that's the one which has to go as a point of principle.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I understand why businesses don't really care.
Yeah, that's it. We just want a trading environment which works, fundamentally.
Yeah.
Right, so we've got six speeches over 3 weeks to look forward to. I, for one, can't wait.
It'll be very, very exciting.
Yes. Yeah. And I just hope that they do go with all the various continental cities. It gives it a certain sense of occasion.
A certain flavour.
Yeah.
The question, of course, is just can the four ministers speaking actually all agree with each other?
Yeah.
And I suspect can Theresa May agree with herself between the second speech and the first speech.
Yeah. Have they just been instructed just to independently write six speeches and hope that they all match up? Right, so here is something which I found quite interesting. Why is the economy not a good measure of if the Brexit process is working, or if Brexit matters?
I wouldn't say it's not necessarily a good indicator.
So it is a good indicator.
Well, I think it can be a good indicator. On the way you read forecasts kind of depends on this. This, of course, is the news this week that the Bank of England has upgraded its growth forecasts for 2018 and beyond. As I said, from all of us.
Well, so Brexit's working.
The Brexit is clearly working, though it's not yet happened. No, I think for all of us, economists, the growth generally at the back end of 2017 surprised us all. No one expected it would be quite as strong as it is. Driven really by two things. Depreciation of sterling, still helping manufacturing and production industries particularly. Mm-hmm. They've done really well. And secondly, global growth. I mean, actually, probably the biggest driver of UK growth in the last 3 to 6 months has been the rapid growth in the European economy, in the American economy, in Southeast Asia. So they've really supported the UK.
Yeah, and it's a tricky one because, for instance, European growth, well, they've got a lot of growth to catch up on.
They have indeed. Yeah, absolutely. You know, they were. You know, we all, of course, the UK and the EU and the rest of the wider world went through the recession in 2008-2009. We had a bit of a wobble, though. We didn't tip back into recession in 2011-2012. Europe then got slammed by the Eurozone crisis and bailing out Cyprus and Greece and all of those issues. So Europe took a while to recover, and it's only in the last sort of 12-18 months it's got going. And the last 6 months, particularly, actually, it's doing very well indeed. Long way to go. You know, unemployment in Greece is still 20%, youth unemployment still 43%. Yeah, there's a hell of a long way to go, but it's recovering well, and that's really supported the UK producers. So yeah, UK growth has been better than we expected. Because of that means actually you have to upgrade next year's forecasts, because essentially the amount of money the UK economy made is much higher than we thought it would be, so next year's forecasts get revised accordingly. So I think you know, we've all been surprised by how well business has ridden this on the whole, but that doesn't mean we're all kind of happy with not seeing any risks in the future. Consumer spending is still slowing. We've been seeing that slowing since the back end of last year. New figures out from Visa this morning. You might think Visa is just one of the cards in your wallet, but it accounts for one in three pounds spent in the UK. So it's an incredibly good barometer. They've seen year on year consumer spending falling for 9 consecutive months now. So there are definitely some concerns about the health of the consumer side. We'll need to wait on and see how that comes.
Now, is it just a sign that economies do what economies do regardless of externalities to a large degree?
Yes, I think mostly so, and I think that's fair. Actually, what we call exogenous factors, those things outside, do have an influence, but they're not necessarily so large. So actually, we're a big trading nation. We're one of the biggest trading nations in the country, but our international trade aspect of our economy is only about 25% of GDP. 75% of what we do is internally generated, as it were, just keeping the UK economy itself spinning over. UK companies supplying to other UK companies who are selling things to UK consumers. That's most of what we do. It's always, we say in economics, everything happens at the margin. It's those little bits that knock things.
The annoying thing that happened following the inflation forecasts and the upgrading of growth forecasts for the next few years was that people immediately leapt to the conclusion that this means that any of the Brexit forecasts that the Bank of England have done are somehow invalidated, or that how can you trust any economic forecast?
That is a good point.
It's not an unreasonable point, but I think it's about how you balance all this stuff. So what we have, you see, is the Bank of England, of course. I mean, people have said the Bank of England has been too pessimistic. The Bank of England has actually been one of the most optimistic forecasters over the past 2 years. They've been on the top edge of everything. But essentially, you've got, you know, it's the same people. It's Jacob Rees-Mogg, it's John Redwood, it's that sort of side. 3 months ago, slating the Bank of England, saying your forecasts are useless, nothing you produce is any good, you're selling the British people short. They upgrade their forecasts, and apparently now the Bank of England forecasting machine is perfect. Because it's telling them what they want to hear. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the challenge in trying to cut through all this and be balanced. Mm. We know, ask any economic forecaster face to face, the one thing we're certain of is our forecast will be wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah? That it's the best we know with the information we have today and the judgments we're taking.
So, I mean, what they've basically done is they've retrospectively looked at what they've said and made adjustments, yeah. And this is why.
The problem is, though, is that there are two different kinds of forecasts, and people are using changes to one, you know, to kind of invalidate the results of the other.
So what are the two different types?
So we're talking about the announcement of last Thursday, right? Super Thursday, which is mm-hmm. about, based on trends and how the economy is currently performing, what is growth likely to be, you know, in a few years' time from now. Whereas, on the other hand, you've got something like the Brexit forecasts, which say, compared to if we didn't Brexit, if we do Brexit, the impact on the economy will be of this magnitude, mm-hmm. essentially. And the two are different things.
Exactly.
And I'm going to use an analogy which I think has been going on Twitter. A guy called Tony Yates, I think, one of his blogs came up with this analogy. He's an economist, good guy to follow. Was that you could not... you couldn't accurately predict, for example, what my weight is going to be in 10 years' time. Because there are so many factors that could change it. There are so many factors that could affect that, right?
Yeah.
But what you could do is do a study that said, all else being equal, if I give up drinking, it will have an effect on my weight of this order of magnitude in 10 years' time, right?
Oh, okay.
And those two things are different. And those are essentially, on the one hand, we've got the growth forecasts that were released on last Thursday. And on the other hand, we've got the Brexit forecasts, which say, compared to if we don't Brexit, if we take the Norway option, GDP will be hit by 2%. The two things don't really interact, and you can't use the results of one to invalidate the results of the other. Because if you were to repeat the study about my weight in 10 years' time, in 2 years' time, there would be new information and new facts
to put into
the equation that might impact upon that. But it doesn't affect at all the conclusions that you draw from the if all else...
Giving up alcohol. Yeah.
If everything else stays the same, I give up alcohol. The results of that forecast still are still exactly the same.
That is excellently put.
It's a very, very good analogy, actually, that's been bouncing around. It gets to a bit of econometric theory that most people sort of never are exposed to, really. The other bit is, called, of course, on the if I say the normal types of forecasting, so not the what will your weight
it's,
be.
It's conditional forecasting, I think.
That's it. Yeah. So on normal sort of macroeconomic forecasting, what we also do as well is we look historically at what the trends are, we look at the information we have today, and we'll also throw in a number of key assumptions.
Okay.
So you'd literally the forecasters will just sit around the table and say, okay, we can model out on the basis of trend, but also what do we think is going on. Now, one of the key assumptions in the Bank of England forecast is there will be a smooth and non-majorly impactful Brexit. That's a key... there's a key influence into the forecast. So the Bank of England forecast has not attempted to model a free trade agreement, a not in the customs union agreement, a migration controls get locked down. None of those things are in that forecast. And so every time you see a forecast, one of the things you always do is say, well, actually, what are your fundamental assumptions? Because you've got to make some. You can't just say, you know, there's a billion possible variables and more over the next month that will affect, you know, where we think the economy will be in a year or 2 years' time. Some of them you're just going to make a call for and go. So we'll make assumptions about where that two-year forecast, we'll make assumptions about where we think bank interest rate will be in 2 years, about its path over those 2 years, about where we think government borrowing will be, about where we think, you know, it's also all done on the government policy stated as of today. So even if we have an inkling that government might be doing a major infrastructure spend that it hasn't yet announced in a year's time, if it's not stated government policy, it isn't used in the forecasting. So the problem is forecasting is, I think, I've talked about this at lectures before, is I think the public look at a forecast, the general public sort of see an economic forecast and think it's somehow like this nailed certainty that this is where we go. It's just our best educated, thought about, carefully worked out, stab in the dark of what we think we know today. That's all it is. In the same way, I guess, when businesses are drawing up your budgets for next year, you've got no certainty about what your income... You've got quite a bit of certainty of your expenditure, yeah, certainly, but your income is massively variable, but you've got to put a number on it.
Yeah.
As you go into your budget setting board meetings, probably any time around now, you will have chosen the total income number, you'll have chosen how you profile it, you'll have chosen how it sits across all your departments, and you'll have allocated some expenditure. That's your best guess. That's all it is. It's educated, but it's only a guess.
I've got a very dry question, tangentially linked to all of that, and so much I simply don't understand. What is the Purchasing Managers Index? How does it work? Who are these people?
So Purchasing Managers Index, some of you listening may have heard of the PMI indices. They're global. They're run, depending in which country in the world you're in, they're run either in conjunction with the Chartered Institute of Purchasing Supply or with Market Economics, which is Market Economics in the UK, that look after them. It is a survey of several hundred purchasing managers weighted for companies.
So first of all, what is a purchasing manager?
Somebody in an organisation who buys stuff.
Right. Okay.
Basically, so someone in charge of internal procurement, okay, usually. So that will certainly be goods and services for your own company to operate, but also those things which will get passed on into your clients in some way or another. They survey several hundred every month on how are your orders, how are your recruitment, how are your employment, general overview of the economy. The number of companies they survey is weighted very carefully, so it matches what the sectors look like across the UK. So there'll be about 80% of, yeah, the sample will be services, about 10% will be manufacturing, about 8% will be construction. And they're asked essentially whether these things are going up, going down, staying broadly similar. And across a very large suite of indicators and a large sample size, you can make very good inferences about the health of the UK economy. And the PMI numbers actually correlate very, very well to eventual outturn.
That's one of the indicators that is currently rolled out, and I scratch my head every time it comes out. I don't know what it means. I have literally no idea.
Yeah,
so what does it actually mean for the economy if, for instance, the index is high?
If it's high, then it looks like the economy is growing. It'll be. You can dive into it. So they publish just one headline number for each section. If you're interested in these things, people, go and have a look at Market Economics website. They're published on the first, second and third working days of the month, covering manufacturing, construction and services, I think in that order. Occasionally they do composite PMIs, they'll do regional PMIs. Essentially, if the number is 50, that sector is stable, not growing or shrinking. Less than 50, it's shrinking. Above 50, it's growing.
Oh, excellent.
It's a nice and simple way of just condensing. It's like what we do with our own quarterly economic survey here. You take a lot of data in, you put it through a nice model, crunch it into one single number, and feed that back out to the public.
Excellent. Well, I have got one more heavyweight topic to get into, but I'm not going to bother because I want to talk about Twitter.
Okay.
So, the MP for Yeovil, someone Fish.
Marcus Fish.
Let's just talk about, because I think we should be like a regular section on this podcast now, things that MPs do on Twitter. What has Mr. Fish done on Twitter?
This is me talking about Twitter world again, so I'll be brief. An article came out over the weekend in The Telegraph looking at the US-Canada border as an example of how the Northern Ireland Irish border might work in the future. And I don't know if it was part of the article, if it was just related to it, but the MP for Yeovil, Marcus Fish, has been over to visit the US-Canada border and then tweeted something out about the fact that only 3% of trucks which cross that border have to be stopped for inspection, suggesting that this might be an okay system for the border in Ireland. And then loads and loads of people on Twitter came out and said that that's not right at all, and that every truck that goes through the border has to go through a first inspection post where they have to supply documentation, blah, 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 blah. And then it's only 3% of those trucks that then have to go through to be x-rayed, checked for stowaways and have, you know, more stringent checks done on them.
So I assume that he took this criticism in good grace and took a backward step from his original position.
No, well, I mean, the first comeback came from Ali Renson, who works for the Institute of Directors, and he's great. You should follow her. Really good on Brexit stuff. She actually advises people on how to get goods across the US-Canada border. And she told him that he was wrong, and he replied, yada, yada. And then Second of all, Sam Lowe, who we've spoken about loads of times before, he works for the Centre for European Research or Reform, one of those, and then he's also part of the UK Trade Forum. Really, really knowledgeable guy. He, again, implied that if you're looking at that border for solutions in Ireland, then you should be looking elsewhere. And once again, Marcus Fish replied, yada, yada.
Yeah, all gravity models, all the rest of it, you know, all these technical people who've studied their whole lives these things are just stupid. And I think this kind of comes back to something I think we were talking about before the podcast, actually, before we start recording, is this sort of bizarre bit where some people have just gone slightly lunatic. Is that generally you've got...
This is something which I did, 100%. I would go over somewhere and I would get the wrong end of the stick. Someone said, oh yeah, well, 3% of our trucks get a... you know, mandatory inspections, which is completely different to some other form of terminology. I'd tweet it out and then I'd get absolutely hammered.
That's it. But the point is, it's okay to be wrong in areas of complexity.
Yeah, but you would say fair enough. Like,
oh, hang on, no. I think I would then escalate to the odd.
Anyway, that's Twitter world.
Yeah, and it's sadly just a thing we see all too often in our politicians. I mean, particularly in the politicians who are generally trying, you know, we need them to steer this through the process, is they're just not listening to advice they've been given. There's this concept that, oh, you
know... Stop leading part of the party.
Exactly, it's that thing. Because it came on to the topic and eventually went into gravity models, didn't it? And it's like, you know, oh, but, you know, gravity models are a nightmare. Wow. You just pretend. And it's like, well, actually... You know, economists across the world disagree on lots and lots of stuff, but there are probably half a dozen topics which are absolutely concretely understood. There's simply no grey area for things. You know, there's some sort of, you know, who pays, where the instance of corporation tax is one of them. Yeah. One of the others is gravity trade models.
Yeah, we go back to Tony Yates because he was involved in that tweet thread, and he said, if Marcus Fisher's got serious evidence that gravity models aren't a thing, then he should be going for the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, because he would win it if he has evidence. Yeah, because that it's concrete. Understood. You know, new and new research comes through every year and it all confirms the same stuff. So, Marcus, if you're listening and you can disprove trade gravity theory, then the Nobels in Sweden will be delighted to hear from you.
Whatever. Right, is there anything going on in the Chamber of Commerce this week that everyone needs to know about? Is this month?
Yeah, well, I think this month the most important thing is I'm going on holiday on Wednesday.
That's
very nice. I'm off to Spain. So I'll check out life over there and report back. I'm going to Cardiff, big port, so we'll see what the excitement of Brexit is down there.
There's going to be lots of stuff happening in the next couple of months, but maybe stuff I won't mention just yet. Stuff that's in the planning.
Cryptic.
Yeah, potential for members to get involved too, if they're interested. A couple of months, we'll have something out there.
Excellent. Right, so tell us where we can find you on Twitter.
I'm at @GMCC_Alex.
And I'm at @GMCC_Christian.
And as always, I'm at @JBeardmore. I will see you next week, probably.
I would have thought so. Yes, yeah, I'm back on Tuesday.
Yep. Fantastic. All right, until then, goodbye.
I'm Andrea, founder of a boutique handbag brand, Andy, and this is why I switched to Shopify. I tried 3 other platforms prior to Shopify, and I remember my breaking point was when I would try to make one little change and my entire site would go down. Shopify made it really easy for me to shift everything over and hit the ground running. I was able to migrate my products and all of my customer information over.
Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Go to shopify.com/listen to take your business to the next level today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.